Chapter 12, Day 5, and Freedom. On November 15, 2011, Dr. Lipkin emailed that Dr. Mikovits would be the study principal investigator in my lab at National Cancer Institute. Her participation was considered essential for the accuracy of the replication study. On November 17, 2011, I was notified of an official internal review of my laboratory conduct of the XMRV affair. On November 30th, Lipkin notified me that NIH, National Institutes of Health, supervisors had banned her from the NIH and security would uphold the ban. The failure to have Dr. Mikovits's full participation meant to me that it was not a full replication study that the NIH wanted. Frank Rossetti. Tuesday, November 22, 2011. The wake-up call came during the hour of farm reports and hot cups of coffee somewhere on the outside. Marie slept like a pile of sandbags, while Mikovits waited by the small window in the door as pre-dawn blackness became light. She could only think that soon she would again enjoy the pre-dawn cup of coffee David made her each day. This was the day of her arraignment, and she expected to make bail. At 9 a.m., a guard told her to get ready to move out. She rolled her mattress and stuffed her blanket and papers in the jail-issued box. Then she was taken to a group of more seasoned inmates in A3 block. They were housed in an overload space in the common room. The guards directed Mikovits to set her box on one of the bunks and wait with the group. From there, the guards would call up individuals, escort them to a holding cell, where they waited for transport for several hours before being shackled to another prisoner, and then loaded onto the bus for the trip to the courthouse. When Mikovits was called up, the guard told her to leave her box, which meant she would have to return even if she made bail. It was extremely discouraging news. The repeat offenders were rowdy. One flirted with the male prisoners, peeling off her shirt to flash them. Drugs like heroin had made a comeback in Southern California, so there was a different kind of combination drug therapy making rounds. A few inmates were pretty rough cut, while some were just big talkers. There was one nicknamed Crazy Mary, who seemed almost giddy. She had been picked up for public drinking, but was homeless, living in a small encampment on a walking trail behind a grocery store in Ventura. Even in Southern California, November and December were tough months to be on the streets, rainy and chilly. Mary was skinny as a rail and had the rough, leathery skin of sun-baked Californians. The guards seemed to like Mary. Mikovits gathered from their playful jabs that Mary got herself picked up a few times a year, normally when the temperature dropped or she needed reliable meals. Mary prattled about current events, somebody's hair, past music festivals. She was fun and light, but Mikovits still hoped to be shackled to another low-key woman she recognized from before, Karen. Instead, as luck would have it, Mikovits was paired with Crazy Mary. For the shackling, one prisoner put her hands behind her back to be handcuffed, and then the shackles and chains were attached to those of another prisoner. The male prisoners were led out first, and then the guards returned for the women. Mikovits and Crazy Mary were the last to get onto the big white bus with black letters identifying Ventura County Sheriff's Office. Every two seats of the interior were housed in an individually locked cage, and they were placed right behind the driver. For the 15-minute ride, they were shackled to each other, locked to the cage, and then locked inside the cage. Chatting up the whole bus, Crazy Mary zeroed in on Mikovits. Mary asked what kind of music she liked, and did she have any brothers or sisters? Mikovits had been staring out the window like someone trapped on a long flight beside a toddler. But Mary turned out to be friendly and funny, so Mikovits dropped her guard. I've got an older brother, a twin sister, and a younger sister, she replied. You got a twin sister? Crazy Mary yelled incredulously over sudden traffic noise. Well, is she just like you? Sometimes we're almost the same, sometimes we're so different, Mikovits replied, with Mary giving a serious nod. The bus pulled up to the Hall of Justice, a drab, four-story Southern California office building with politely placed fountains and palm trees. It was a civic structure of facile appearances, an illusion of order and security. But instead of stopping at the public entrances, the bus drove to the cavernous underground garage, pulling up to an area often referred to as the dungeons, where prisoners were held before court appearances. They were led toward a holding cell where the group of about eight women shared a single toilet and a few benches. On the way there, one guard offered a paper bag lunch of two pieces of white bread and a slice of bologna. Mikovits was about to hand it back when Crazy Mary protested, "Don't!" and snatched the crinkly brown paper from Mikovits's hand. Undernourished and obviously not sure when she was going to eat again, Mary wolfed down both sandwiches. After what seemed like an incredibly long time, but was probably not much longer than 2 hours, they were escorted from their cells, up a back elevator, and were placed in a specially designed cage at the back of the courtroom. From a prisoner's cage behind the judge's bench, Mikovits could see David and some of her friends in the spectators' gallery. Her lawyer, a prominent criminal defense attorney, stood a slim 6'3", with a smooth-shaved head, glasses, and a sharp professional air. "It's all right," were the first words he said to her, adding that he knew she didn't want to be extradited to Reno and would not let it happen. She was greatly relieved. "But there's another issue," said her attorney. "There's a reporter here from Science, John Cohen. He wants to take a picture of you in court." Mikovits recalled how Cohen had been the one who included the comment from Coffin in the Science article the previous September, comparing her to Joan of Arc. Cohen was also the writer Coffin had designated at the invitation-only meeting in July of 2009 at the National Cancer Institute, 3 months prior to the publication of the XMRV article, to explain the story to the public. Mikovits couldn't help but believe that Cohen was playing for the other team. Mikovits told her lawyer she did not want her picture taken. Cohen painted the scene for the readers of Science Insider in his November 22, 2011 piece entitled "Inmate Mikovits Meets Judge." The article described her entering room 13 of the Superior Court in a prison-issued blue jumpsuit with an orange t-shirt underneath. The area for the inmates in the courtroom was a room within the room that had white metal bars for walls, the four bailiffs with taser guns, and the other inmates who were heavily muscled and tattooed men and street-tough women. Cohen noted that the 53-year-old Mikovits appeared composed, but wildly out of place. It seemed to Mikovits that as she was talking to her attorney, Cohen was looking for an opportunity to photograph her disheveled state. She told this to her attorney, and he obliged by blocking her from Cohen's view. After blocking Cohen from taking any possible shot, he told Mikovits that she would probably be released on bail to her own recognizance. What she did not know at the time was that after the call from Max and Harvey, David had found the notebooks in the box of towels and linens and surrendered them to the police only a few hours earlier. After the judge heard about a dozen other cases, Mikovits pled not guilty and waived extradition to Reno. The judge then asked about Cohen's photo request. Mikovits and her attorney vehemently answered no. The judge asked Cohen to speak about why he wanted the picture. Cohen asserted that a photograph could let others in the science world see what was possible in these situations. Mikovits felt that she was being displayed as a warning for anyone in science who dared venture into controversial areas. The judge noted that Mikovits had not been convicted of any crime and concluded, "I can see no benefit to the scientific community in putting the picture of a woman presumed innocent in a professional journal." An extradition specialist then took the podium to detail why extradition to Reno was not required. Her attorney joined him in explaining to the judge that Mikovits had owned her home in Ventura County since July of 2003, that she'd had a normal homing instinct right after being fired and returned to her home, and she was no flight risk. The two of them explained how Mikovits had been welcomed back to her community, a fact supported by the many friends from her church and yacht club who were in the courtroom. After confirming that she could post bail, the judge ordered that she did not have to appear in Reno and that she be released immediately from custody. Unbeknownst to Mikovits, a very different chain of events had been taking place in Reno, Nevada, New York City, and Bethesda, Maryland. A conference call was held on Monday, November 21, 2011, the day before her arraignment, between Rossetti, Lipkin, and Harvey and Annette Whittemore to discuss securing Mikovits's release from jail and settling the civil lawsuit against her. Rossetti recalled, "Mr. Whittemore started the conversation by saying, 'We told Judy that she could have a copy of the notebooks.' I replied, 'I have read the application for TRO, temporary restraining order, and that is a bold-faced lie.'" Before a verbal fight could ensue, Lipkin interrupted and emphatically told Whittemore that the culture of scientific community demands that scientists have access to their data and that of their students, for multiple reasons. Whittemore was insistent that the notebooks had to be returned before Mikovits, we always referred to her as Judy, could post bail and be released from jail. When the conference call was over, Rossetti and Lipkin talked privately about the situation, and Rossetti sent a follow-up email to Harvey, in which he wrote that many of Judy's relatives believed Harvey was capable of doing her physical harm. Harvey emailed back that, "We would never do anyone physical harm. That is just simply insane," then advised Frank not to become an accessory after the fact, and suggested her lawyers should immediately call the Washoe County District Attorney. Rossetti then called Whittemore and told him, "I didn't appreciate being threatened." Harvey replied that his response was not a threat, just friendly advice. The notebooks were returned to the Ventura County Sheriff's Office in Southern California first thing in the morning of Tuesday, November 22, 2011, by Mikovits's husband, David Noldy. Later that morning, Harvey sent the following email to Rossetti. "Frank, the first positive step has taken place, but the damage continues because Judy's lawyers failed to provide a statement to her bloggers to stop the stupid attacks on the WPI and Annette. If David can help Judy understand this and direct these people to simply stop, we will have a very good chance of a positive outcome. I will do everything I can to help the authorities get her out of jail today in time for Thanksgiving with her family. This is not my decision, but I will help as is appropriate." Frank discussed the situation some more with Harvey Whittemore that day. Whittemore told Rossetti that Mikovits needed to pay the Whittemore-Peterson Institute $200,000 in restitution for their investigation, even though he knew she did not have that kind of money. Whittemore also wanted Mikovits to sign an apology letter so that the internet bloggers would stop their attacks on the WPI and the Whittemores. Rossetti then told Mr. Whittemore that the stimulus for the bloggers' attack was WPI's illegal firing of Judy, the legal attack by WPI against Judy, and WPI's arrangement to have her thrown in jail. Frank eventually tried to edit an apology letter drafted by Harvey and Annette Whittemore. He was aided in this effort by Ian Lipkin, but the two of them became convinced that the apology, as written by the Whittemores, was an admission of guilt and had criminal consequences. A selection of some of the passages, which they found to be problematic. "I am deeply and honestly sorry from the depths of my heart and soul for causing great harm to the Whittemore-Peterson Institute, patients around the world who counted on me, and all those who work at the Institute. I deeply regret that I am responsible for allowing those closest to me to create a cesspool of mistrust about the Whittemores, telling lies about them, and not stopping the malicious rumors from spreading out of control when I could have. The Whittemores have done nothing to deserve this horrible treatment by me, my friends, and those who think they are acting on my behalf. I promise to restore the faith that all of you had in me by dedicating my life to honest and careful scientific discovery. I want to make full restitution to those I have hurt by having my apology posted on all blogs, forums, and websites by those who have inaccurately reported stories adverse to the interests of the Institute and those associated with it. But the effort foundered when Rossetti became convinced that the Whittemores were going to use the apology against her in a civil hearing, scheduled in Reno, Nevada, on November 22, 2011, the same day Judy was scheduled for her arraignment in Southern California. Rossetti could not understand how a person who was in jail in one state could be expected to prepare her defense for a case in another state. For Rossetti, it all looked like a rigged game, and he didn't want any part of it. When this became clear to Rossetti after Harvey's urgent texts that the apology needed to be signed that day, he recalled, "I did not call Mr. Whittemore because I knew that Dr. Lipkin and I had been duped and Harvey was planning to use the apology as a confession against Judy at the hearing." After her termination from the WPI, but before her arrest, Mikovits wanted to continue her work with Lipkin on the XMRV replication study. On November 15, 2011, she sent him an email which seemed to set the ground rules for the study. She wrote to Lipkin, "Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do the replication study in Frank Rossetti's lab at the NCI. I understand that no money can be given for these studies, but that you can provide resources, such as PCR and culture supplies and sequencing or other services, contracted through a third party. Frank will need to get permission for me to work as a special volunteer from Drs. Fauci and Varmus in order for me to work in his lab." Anthony Fauci was head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and Harold Varmus was head of the National Cancer Institute. As things eventually shaped up, the agreement for Mikovits's participation in the Lipkin multicenter study must surely rank as one of the most unusual in all of science. In an email sent on December 1, 2011 to Varmus and copied to Fauci and Rossetti, Lipkin wrote that Mikovits would be associated with the National Cancer Institute for purposes of the replication study, but she could not step foot on the NCI campus, a prohibition which would be enforced by security. Rossetti would later call this banning of a scientist from working in a lab and yet wanting to have her name on the ensuing paper unprecedented in contemporary American science. Mikovits strongly believed that her questions about XMRV, ME/CFS, autism, and the possible role of vaccines had caused consternation at the highest levels of the scientific community. But in her wildest dreams, she'd never imagined a scientific study of international importance would contain a clause which held that a scientist would be designated as working at a specific lab, the National Cancer Institute, where she'd been employed for more than 20 years, but also provide that the scientist could not step foot on the grounds of that lab or would be escorted away by security. It was a little like the Catholic Church allowing Galileo to participate in a replication study, but then denying him the use of his telescope. Mikovits thought she'd be released soon after the hearing, but she and Karen were ordered to get back on the bus. Mikovits protested, but a guard said there was no paperwork authorizing her release. As they were processed at Todd Road, the receiving guard saw the names and exclaimed, "You're not supposed to be here." Within an hour, both Karen and Judy were in a van heading back to the Ventura County Courthouse. Back in the catacombs, Mikovits joined the prisoners who had made bail and were slowly transitioning back to freedom. Their clothes and personal belongings were returned. For Mikovits, this meant gym clothes, flip-flops, and her baseball cap. She had also surrendered her wedding ring after the arrest, slipping it into her gym shorts pocket. It had not been off since she married David in 2000, so she had the thought that he should be the one to put it back on. The guards offered another bag lunch, and Mikovits had the good sense to take it, handing it off to Crazy Mary. Mary was still chatting, occasionally flitting over to Mikovits to ask a question. At one point, she asked, "What were you in here for?" Mikovits explained her story. Mary listened in rapt attention, then shouted, "This is a doctor. This is a PhD. She's in here because she stole her own brain." Mikovits couldn't help wondering why it seemed her story only made sense to a homeless woman with something of a sketchy grasp of reality. Mary's shouts attracted two sergeants. One of them asked Mikovits, "So you're a PhD?" "Yeah," said Mikovits. "When I came in, they only asked me if I'd graduated from high school, and I said yes. I figured I shouldn't answer questions you didn't ask." The guards started laughing. Since cancer is such a universal disease, a few of them asked if she might have anything to offer their family members or friends with cancer. Mikovits said sure and collected a few of their cards. Wherever Mikovits went, it seemed like she was picking up patients. Mikovits and Karen were ushered out at the same time and ushered out into the nearly empty lobby of the Ventura County Courthouse at the same time, but neither of their husbands were there. The two of them walked out into the large parking lots, looking around in vain. Mikovits remembered a nearby restaurant and thought they might let her use the phone to call David. But Karen wanted to continue looking in the parking lot. "I hope you get your brain back," she said wryly, in parting, though Mikovits was more concerned about getting her reputation and credibility back. At the Hill Street Cafe, Mikovits asked to use their phone to call bail bondsman Bill Burns to arrange a meeting. She also called David. When Bill arrived, he found Mikovits a little dazed, drinking a beer at the counter. Burns would later recall she had just this sense of wonder about what had happened to her. It was Bill's experience that among people who had spent their whole lives outside of the criminal justice system and suddenly found themselves at its mercy, there was often a wide-eyed amazement at what can happen to a person. This was often coupled with a profound relief at leaving jail. David walked in soon, and they headed over to Bill's office, signed the papers, copied their driver's licenses on the Xerox, and wished each other a happy Thanksgiving. The Nolde clan had planned to spend the holiday week at the Sonoma Mission Inn, starting the previous Sunday, but David had gotten them to hold the reservation. Mikovits said she didn't want to go back to their house because it would only serve as a reminder of her upsetting arrest. She asked that he simply pack a suitcase of their things and they start driving north from the cafe. They planned to have lunch with one of David's sons in San Francisco the next day, then make the final hour and a half drive from the city to the pastoral Sonoma wine country, dappled with gnarled old grapevines. "Try not to speed," Bill Burns said as he left them. They headed up north in their 2003 blue Audi A6, and it was clear to Judy that her husband was rattled. He relayed how he'd been on the phone constantly with Frank and Harvey over the past few days, trying to figure out a solution to everything. He mentioned Harvey's apology letter and showed it to her. She started to read it with trepidation and finally said, "I'd never sign this." David said nothing. He stared ahead with tears of frustration and relief welling. "We just wanted to get you out before Thanksgiving." Judy also learned what had happened to her friend, Lily Meehan, on the day of her arrest. Lily had first read about Mikovits shortly after the October 8, 2009 publication of her XMRV article in the journal Science. When she noticed Mikovits's email address as the senior author, she jotted off a message about her close family member who'd been struck by ME/CFS at the age of 15 and was completely disabled. Lily was surprised when Mikovits speedily wrote back and found that the scientist often spent weekends and vacations at her Oxnard, California home, as luck would have it, not far from where Lily lived. They made plans to have lunch when Mikovits came home for the Christmas holidays. Mikovits told her to be sure to bring her family member with ME/CFS if that person could manage it. When they sat down for lunch, Mikovits quickly asked the family member about her symptoms, such as light sensitivity, nausea, post-exertional fatigue, the kind of questions the other doctors almost never asked, that Lily knew as central features. The women became fast friends, and when the unpleasantness started with the Whittemores, Lily had launched a public outcry. As the situation deteriorated from a wrongful termination into a civil lawsuit on November 9, 2011, Lily publicly posted a response from Mikovits's attorney at the time. If she had understood more about legal culture, she would have fully comprehended the bad strategy of publishing it. But since Annette was posting accusations against Mikovits on the WPI's Facebook page, it was already public. Shortly before her arrest, Mikovits was convinced she was being followed. Lily believed it was a credible threat. Soon after, from the second floor of her house, Lily saw a man walking along the sidewalk and suspected he was a process server for the Whittemores. Moments later, he rang her doorbell. Lily froze and stayed quiet in her home and then did a few chores. She soon heard men's voices in her backyard, and then three men entered her house through the back door. Within a minute, Lily counted a total of 9 police officers in her home. They sat her in the recliner in her living room while the police officers searched her house, handing her an odd search warrant. It listed her address, the issuing judge, the Honorable R. Wright, and the case agent supervisor, Detective Horrigan, but not any items for which they were searching. Lily later showed the search warrant to her sister-in-law, a paralegal. Because of the lack of specificity in the text, Lily's sister-in-law simply stated, "Something powerful is behind this." With Lily in her recliner and two policemen standing guard, the rest of the officers searched her house. For Lily, who considered herself a model citizen, having been married 36 years and never having gotten so much as a traffic ticket, it was both surreal and traumatizing. She heard police officers rifling through boxes that had been in the attic for years. "I kept wondering how this could happen," she later explained. Mikovits called Lily at 8:15 the morning after her release to apologize for what she had endured. "Those were her notebooks," Lily later said with outrage. "She was the principal investigator. They couldn't deny them to her. She was supposed to have them." The next morning, while David was showering, his cell phone rang. Judy picked it up. "Hello?" she said. "Is David there?" asked the familiar voice of Harvey Whittemore. "He's in the shower. I shouldn't be talking to you, but have David call me," said Harvey brusquely. There was a pause in his voice, something that Mikovits hoped was a small shred of humanity from a man she'd considered family for the past 5 years. "I'm really glad you're out of jail," he said gruffly. "Yeah, right," said Mikovits, hanging up. She didn't even tell David about the call. Later, they were driving up to San Francisco to visit David's son for lunch, when a call came in from her civil attorney, Dennis Neal Jones. "You need to turn yourself in at the Reno courthouse on Monday morning," he said. Mikovits said the judge in Ventura ruled she was free on bail, so she wasn't going. But Jones insisted it was mandatory. "You'll be in and out in a couple hours," he promised. He'd found criminal attorneys for her in Reno. They were now handling the criminal case. A preliminary injunction had been issued from the Reno court on November 22, 2011, the day she'd been arraigned in Southern California, and it ordered her to make copies of all her personal emails to provide them to the court. When Mikovits phoned, the attorney answered and seemed to know her case. Mikovits told the attorney she had been released on bail and was not turning herself into the court in Reno, as she never possessed any property of the WPI. The attorney insisted that if Mikovits did not turn herself in, she would be picked up and jailed. Mikovits unleashed her frustration. She had paid the bail, and besides that, she had not seen the notebooks or the birthday bag since October 17th. The attorney repeated that she must be there by 11 a.m. on Monday, or police would pick her up. On their vacation at the Sonoma Mission Inn, David and Judy went to an Apple store and bought an iPad and tried to download all 22,000 emails from Mikovits's personal Gmail accounts, excluding the ones that contained classified patient information or the ones irrelevant to her WPI work. Mikovits and her husband drove directly from Sacramento to the Reno office of her new criminal attorneys, Scott Freeman and Tammy Riggs. The attorneys escorted them to the courthouse where they were besieged by news reporters. Mikovits was booked, had her mugshot taken, and told she was free to go. But someone else was waiting in Reno, John Cohen of Science. And he finally got the mugshot denied him by the California judge, a mugshot to adorn his article on Mikovits. "Dispute over lab notebooks lands researcher in jail," was the headline in the December 2, 2011 issue of Science, complete with the mugshot. One issue that needs to be addressed is how Frank Rossetti's name came to appear on a paper authored by John Coffin entitled Multiple Sources of Contamination in Samples from Patients Reported to Have XMRV Infection, published in February of 2012. For many following the XMRV story, it seemed a significant change in Rossetti's support of Mikovits and her investigation, especially since he was Mikovits's mentor and one of her most prominent and respected supporters. In July of 2014, Rossetti explained how his name came to be on the paper. In August 2010, blood samples drawn from the homes of patients and controls were sent to my lab at NCI, where cells and plasma were separated and sent to the Drug Resistance Program, DRP, directed by Coffin. They reported that on August 23rd, all four ME/CFS patient plasma had MLV and mouse DNA, but no XMRV, while 2/5 normal had XMRV, but no MLV or mouse DNA. These patients had not been found to be XMRV positive. Nothing was said about this data for almost a year after the SOK, State of Knowledge 2011, conference, where Alter stated there was no evidence of contamination at the WPI. I was never allowed to see any of the data before my bosses. It smelled like an inquisition. I was aghast when I saw a draft of the paper. The original 2010 data was in the paper without any replication, and the tone of the paper placed most of the blame for multiple contamination on the WPI and Dr. Mikovits. Since there was no evidence in this paper supporting that contamination, and my belief the XMRV presence in the normal donors came from making of the DNA in the Coffin lab, I declined to be an author. On October 6, 2011, a week after Dr. Mikovits had been terminated from the WPI, I was told it would be good for my career if I was a co-author. Since there was an internal review of my program looming, and a reevaluation of funding in 2 years instead of the usual four, I relented and consented. As a scientist, Mikovits was trained to consider data points to determine if any larger patterns could be found. First, she'd been arrested at her home on Friday, November 18, 2011, without an arrest warrant, and held without bail until Tuesday, November 22, 2011. Second, because she'd been in jail in Southern California, she couldn't prepare for or appear in Reno, Nevada, on Tuesday, November 22, 2011, for the civil case brought by the Whittemores. At that hearing, the judge issued a preliminary order that she turn over all of her emails, something she could not do according to privacy laws regarding study participants. Third, the most powerful scientific authorities in her field, Anthony Fauci of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases and Harold Varmus of the National Cancer Institute, wanted her name on the Lipkin Multicenter study, but didn't want her setting foot in a lab, an edict they were willing to back up with security. Fourth, at her Southern California hearing, the judge had denied John Cohen's request for a picture of her in her prison garb, and denied that she had to appear in Reno. Fifth, after being released, it was suddenly mandatory that she appear in Reno, and when she arrived, John Cohen was waiting. "You must really have pissed off someone important," the bail bondsman, Bill Burns, had told Mikovits after he first investigated her case. Mikovits was starting to believe she must have pissed off a lot of important people.